Okay, let's take a look at the overview of textual criticism. But what I'm going to start out with is, if you have a Greek text or if you have an English Bible, either one will be fine. I'd like for you to open to Matthew 24 and Mark 13. With a maroon cover. There it is. Okay. Now, let's look at Matthew 24:36. Matthew 24:36 reads, "But concerning that day and that hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven." Then there's a textual variant. The majority text does not add words that will be found in a critical text. I'll point again where the variant is. "Concerning that day and that hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven." Here's where the variant would go. And then without the variant, "but only my Father." Now, when you're looking at translations, what translations are you looking at?
Yes, me.
King
James.
Okay, so your text read like mine, didn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yours didn't. What does your text have that mine didn't?
Nor the Son.
Let me read you what Bruce Metzger, a recognized textual critic who favored, he's with the Lord now, so I'm sure he knows better now. But in Matthew 24:36, he's going to explain why he thinks that the majority family of manuscripts do not read neither the Son. And here's what he says. "The words, neither the Son, are lacking in a majority of the witnesses of Matthew, including the later Byzantine text. On the other hand, the best representatives of the Alexandrian and Western types of text contain the phrase. The omission of these words because of the doctrinal difficulty they present is more probable than the addition by assimilation to Mark 13:32. So what he's saying is, he thinks that majority family scribes said, those words are coming out because it says something bad about Jesus, saying that he doesn't know something. Now, as you read what Metzger has to say, there's a certain plausibility about it. But now let's look at Mark 13:32, and it will be word for word identical except for the issue of the textual variant. And the majority text of 13:32 reads even the same as the critical text. Let's see, it would help if I got to 13. "But concerning that day and or hour, no one knows, neither the angels in heaven nor the Son, but only the Father." Now, in a couple of the best critical texts of the books of Mark and Matthew, this is how much text there is, and this is how much variation that they catalog. In looking at those and looking through these volumes, I've only found two manuscripts in Mark that omit the phrase "neither the Son." Some of these manuscripts were done by the same scribe copying Matthew as copying Mark. So if a scribe had a theological problem in Matthew, why didn't the same scribe have a theological problem in Mark? So what I will propose is that much of what we see written has a certain view of majority family manuscripts. I will call them majority family rather than Byzantine. That's the common name. There have been other names that they've gone by, like Syrian, like the Koine text, like the Imperial text. There are a whole bunch of names. I'm just going to call it the majority family. But ever since Westcott and Hort wrote in 1881, the common view has been to say that they are an inferior set of manuscripts, and generally it's a very dismissive attitude. But what I would have to say is we need to look at issues fairly, and there's a fair amount of propaganda out there because people are convinced that the majority family is an inferior family of
and why is that?
Because it has been argued that it came about late. But that's a suppositional argument. We'll end up getting into how it is that people have come to view. What I would have to say is that Zane Hodge's description of what has to be answered is really a major issue. By the way, if you want to give me your email addresses, I can email a major paper that I have written on this. If you'd like to pass around something, and then I'll send you a paper called Majority Text, Retrospect and Prospect. I had planned to bring it, but and just in the process of bringing all this, there are certain things I forgot to bring. But what I would say is, Zane's explanation of what has to be answered, I think, is a fair description. What he argued is that an answer must give a reasonable accounting for why 80% of the manuscripts are very, very, very much alike, but are later. And 20% of manuscripts, which are earlier, are very, very different from each other. And what has happened is generally people come up with a very well-reasoned argument for one part of the text, but not a well-reasoned statement of the other part of the data. And unless a person has a comprehensive answer, the possibility that it is skewed is high. And so what Zane argued for is a way of looking at the manuscripts as a whole. And so that is what I will propose, and if I don't, you hold me to it. I mean, in other words, that's what I'm going to need to be able to do. I will demonstrate a reason for seeing the majority family manuscripts as superior, despite the fact that we don't have any representatives earlier than the 5th century. There's a portion of manuscript Washingtonius, which is an unsealed manuscript. There's a portion of the Book of Luke that is a very solid member of the majority family. One of the problems when you look at manuscripts is a scribe, his text will look like what he's copying from. And so in Washingtonius, portions of the text, that's name of a manuscript, there are portions of it that are definitely majority family, and there are portions that are Alexandrian family. So you can't say, what does Washingtonius look like? Oh, by the way, guess where he got his name? It's in Washington, D.C. now. And so it's not a whole manuscript, but there's a sizable portion that includes Luke 9, which I collated. I collated about 8 manuscripts in that section. Collation is, I'll show you what collation can look like. You probably have seen textual apparatuses where it just shows, you know, these are the variants here and here and here, and they're just hit and miss.
Before going much further.
But this is a horizontal line presentation. What Swanson did in all these volumes, he died after completing Galatians, he had a group of manuscripts, and he would say on the first line, what Vaticanus, that's manuscript B, which is the favorite manuscript for critical text people outside of the book of Revelation, what it reads and its allies on the first line. The next line will show a little bit different reading and a little different reading and so on and so forth. The more readings that you see for a particular line, it's saying that the text tradition just went every which direction. So you're closer, so I'll pass it this way.
That's
yes.
Before going much further, can you please give just a brief summary of what the majority family is and
okay.
the Alexandrian family?
Okay, very good. Okay. Thank you. Alexandrian family would be manuscripts that came out of the city of Alexandria, Egypt. In the history of things, you know that Alexander the Great conquered vast territory, and he died at a very young age, and his four generals took over. One of those generals was named Ptolemy, and each one of the generals was trying to become the number one of the four. So guess what Ptolemy did in order to make sure that he would have his claim to fame? He brought the dead body of Alexander all the way from out in India, clear to Egypt. And can you imagine what that thing smelled like by the time they arrived? So he said, I've got his dead body. I'm obviously his successor. Well, Ptolemy was doing everything to make Egypt, which was his rule, it was Greek Egypt now, the supreme part of the Greek Empire. He wanted it to be greater than even Athens. So among the other things that he did, he built the world's greatest library, and they were very much aiming at proving that they were the best, and they had the best manuscripts, and textual criticism was alive and well long before the Christian era in Alexandria. Papyrus was the main writing material. And of course, Egypt had large quantities of it because of the Nile Delta. So Alexandria became known as a great book center for the world. And so if you have a place where there are already lots of trained scribes, it's not surprising that that would become a center that would be wanting to produce Christian manuscripts. And so the Alexandrian manuscripts that most English versions, other than, of course, King James, New King James, and Young's literal translation have favored, are those Alexandrian manuscripts. They do tend to be the earliest manuscripts for several reasons. One of them that we'll get into is going to be an accident of climate and technology. We'll talk about that a little later. But another reason for favoring them is that they are earlier. Now, there's a natural reason that they have to be earlier. After the Muslims took over Egypt, they weren't allowing much Christian publishing to go on. So therefore, they couldn't extend late into the transmission history. Furthermore, after the Muslims took over, lots of manuscripts were purposefully destroyed. So therefore, any of the manuscripts that had gone out from Alexandria are going to be preserved, and they have generally an earlier date to them. And there's a general preference for earlier is better. And I would say, all other things equal, earlier is better. Would I rather have a 5th century majority family manuscript than a 13th century one? Yes, absolutely. Because manuscripts, as they go down the chain, cannot improve. They will gradually disintegrate. They will gradually have errors that will creep in. But the question becomes, do all manuscripts decay at the same rate? In other words, do all scribes copy equally as well? And we'll get into that. I would say that there is good reason to say that the Alexandrian manuscripts are not, they do not evidence the type of copying that the Byzantine or majority family ones do. So, earlier is regarded as better. That's the reason that most modern translations favor the Egyptian or the Alexandrian manuscripts. But they are a minority of manuscripts. And, by the way, Zane did not coin the term majority text. It was coined by Kurt Aland, who before his death headed up the translation of the Text Resource Center in Munster, Westphalia, Germany. And so the Nessel Aland text or the United Bible Society's text are a critical text, very similar to the Westcott and Hort text, which you probably have heard of. And so those are the primary representatives of the Alexandrian manuscripts. And essentially, for various reasons, the later majority family manuscripts have been regarded as inferior. Okay, have I essentially covered that? Yes, Lex?
Maybe this is not a good time to introduce this question, and that's fine if you want to save it for later, but do you think there was, in all of this, driven, motivated by a desire of apostasy, or just... it is scholarly different approaches to things, and maybe a professional...
Are you talking about the modern scholars, or are you talking about the manuscripts?
I'm talking about manuscripts, where they say it was intentional to try and reduce the deity of Christ. Is that happening, or is it more just an academic type of
thing? This is a published form of a dissertation by Harry Sturz. He was for many years a professor at Biola. It's a little difficult to get a hold of this book. It's out of print. But it's called The Byzantine Text Type and New Testament Textual Criticism. He has some very interesting citations that I mention later in the notes. I don't cite them, but I mention that they exist. About the year 200... we see letters that are sent out to various places within Christendom that warned, when these people come to your church, they're going to be trying to say certain things. Make sure to check their manuscripts against your better manuscripts. So there is evidence that there was a care and concern that can be documented about the year 200 in various parts of the empire, in which there was a guard being taken against readings that were meant to discredit what the text had said. So as far as intentional errors, I see... I would agree with what is a pretty broad consensus that probably most of those are pre-200. And so we can definitely have intentional errors introduced early, but in all probability, not many of them that would have a major impact came in after that.
Okay.
And so... yeah, that's a good question. Okay, let's look at first the... because I don't want to forget this. This is the standard lexicon for Greek New Testament. This is the third edition, Bauer, Danker, Artin, Gingrich lexicon. This is the authoritative lexicon for the New Testament. So a lexicon is a specialized kind of dictionary. It's one where the authors stick out their necks by saying how they define certain words in certain passages. The difference between a dictionary and a lexicon, if the two terms are not used synonymously, is a lexicon needs to prove or validate their range of meaning by giving you passages in which they say, in this passage, you can see that it means this. And you look at this passage, and it shows that the word has to include this idea. Not just, well, the word can mean this, or it can mean this, or it can mean that. So that's dictionary. For New Testament studies, you don't want dictionaries. You want lexicons. You want someone to stick their neck out and say, I will show you the passages that should lead you to my conclusion. And then they will give you bibliography to say where it reads. So this is regarded as the premier lexicon. Now, this is controlled by the Nestle-Aland group at this point in time. Third edition came under their control, or actually sixth edition German did. Sometimes it's necessary, and it's often necessary for them to say, but there's a variant reading. Not all manuscripts of this passage read this way. Guess who in the third edition they cite for saying what the majority family reads? When in here you see this abbreviation, GNT, Greek New Testament, MT. That's the Greek New Testament according to the majority text, Hodges and Farstad. In earlier editions, they had used the Textus Receptus. Textus Receptus is just a name for a printed Greek text. Now, when I say printed, I mean not a handwritten one. And so its predecessor came soon after the printing press, which was in the 1400s. So it was in the 1500s that printed Greek text came out. Eventually, for an interesting reason, it became known as the Textus Receptus. Now, how did that text come about? A man named Erasmus, who was a little older than Martin Luther, went out and bought a couple manuscripts, and he created his text out of it. Now, if you go out on the market and you buy a couple manuscripts, you might buy really good ones or you might buy really bad ones. But since the majority of manuscripts were within the majority family, it's not surprising that he picked representatives within the majority family. But those of us who hold to a majority text view, and even Aland and his group, would say that it wasn't a very good representative of the majority family. It was within the family, but it wasn't a very good representative. So when they want to say, what do they think was the original reading within the Byzantine or majority family? They turn to the same text that I use, because they recognize this as a critical text that applied scientific methodology in order to determine what was most likely the original reading. They would say the original Byzantine reading, whereas I would say that it does a good job at determining what the original reading as a whole would be. So, in other words, there is recognition that the majority text theory is a good way to find out what the original reading of the Byzantine family was. But now the question becomes, is that determining also what the original reading of the text was? Aland's group would say no. I would say yes. But what I'm wanting to say is, Majority text is not a method practiced by a bunch of country hicks. It was being practiced by people who were serious scholars and who are recognized as having determined very well what the original reading of at least the Byzantine family would be. So I think that's an important thing to say. It's quite different than the text of Erasmus, the so-called Textus Receptus, because that just happened to be what manuscripts did he buy. No scientific procedure there, it's just where he could get the best bargain, and so forth. Okay, let's now look at an overview of textual variation. There are only four types of textual variation that are possible. They can either be order or content. One type of order variation, and that will be transposition. Three kinds of content variation: addition, omission, substitution. So let's assume that the original reading of the passage was Jesus Christ. If it's going to be transposed, Christ Jesus. And this is a two-word transposition. When you get into multiple words, you get all kinds of permutations. Content variation. There could be addition. A copyist could say, Lord Jesus Christ. I copied from the wrong one. Textual criticism is getting me into trouble today.
Is this a virtual class? Are you demonstrating what you're talking about?
I remember a lecture where I was talking about textual criticism. I was invited to speak at Fuller Seminary. And I had an embarrassing textual variant, and I was saying such and such, and people are looking at it really funny, and I finally looked at my overhead, and I saw that I had really misspelled a basic word. I was saying, see, it reads this. No, it doesn't. omission. Instead of saying Jesus Christ, it says just Jesus, or it could just say Christ. And substitution is simultaneous addition and omission. It omits Jesus Christ, and it adds a Semitic equivalent. All textual variation comes down to these. But I do want you to note that when you list a variant in an apparatus, that listing is inherently biased. If I say this is an omission, it was supposed to read Jesus Christ and reads Jesus. Well, the person from a different standpoint could say, oh, no, that's not an omission. That's an addition. Because people speak from the text that they prefer. So anytime you hear someone say, this is an omission, well, someone else would say it's an addition. So I just want to point that out. So when you read people, they're going to give you a description of what they see having happened. But that's based on which manuscripts that they're taking as original, and which ones that they're saying did the alteration. And so I can read what a critical text person says and say, well, okay, I know what they're saying. I would say it differently. I can understand what they're saying, but everyone says it in a biased way. Now, I did a dissertation that was on the synoptic problem, but it ended up with the same types of issues. So I worked at being able to state it in a neutral way. So I did come up with a way to do that in my dissertation. I was arguing that Mark was the third synoptic gospel. It is the only color dissertation accepted at Dallas. I have 700. I have 70 pages of Greek text in color in it. It was a statistical argument. We won't get into that. Okay. Yes.
What is the base for that series there that shows variants that you passed around? What is it using? Is it using Alexandrian? Or?
Yes. He was a student of... Reuben Swanson was a student of Bruce Metzger. and he used Vaticanus as his model. He died before getting past Galatians. Obviously, if he did Revelation, since Vaticanus didn't have Revelation in it, he would have had to switch. And there, Alexandrinus is usually the critical text people's favorite manuscript for the book of Revelation.
Is there a majority text version of this where they start with the majority text?
No. Swanson's horizontal line synopsis is unique.
Okay.
It's a really nice sort of thing because typically it's impossible to reconstruct a text from an apparatus. And the reason for that is because all sorts of minor variations are just ignored. And so you can't say, well, this is what this manuscript reads for this section. It takes doing something along this line. But even though he did it from a critical text standpoint, he does identify which line is the majority family.
Oh.
However, what I have noticed is that his collation sample is much more heavily weighted towards Alexandrian manuscripts. So it has its biases within it, but it's a very helpful tool. And it's a different way of looking at it. So when I talk about collation, I'm talking about doing something like what he did. And so I did collation of a couple of chapters in Luke. That's a very tedious project, I guarantee. Now, this will initially sound very scary, so I don't want it to be such. But there are about 300,000 variants in the New Testament. That's about 2 variants per word. So, you know, that can initially be very, very scary. We say, can I really trust my text? Well, there's an embarrassment of riches. We've got 5,000 continuous text manuscripts. And any of the major textual theories that are out there are going to do a pretty good job of eliminating most of the really it-couldn't-be kinds of errors. Let me just say this. I don't have a TR with me, but let me hold up my New King James because that's pretty close for a translation. Between the majority text, Hodges Farsad, this was with a fancy binding on it, so it's just the same text as what Brad has or like this right here. Between these two texts, there are about a little less than 8,000 variants. So although these two textual schools see things very much differently, out of 300,000, both of them would agree on eliminating most of those. Now, I was holding up the wrong ones and saying 7,000, almost 8,000. Between the Textus Receptus, represented by this New King James, and the majority text, there are about 1,900 differences. Between the majority text and the nestle along what underlies, like the ESV and so on and so forth, there would be almost 8,000. So what we see is any school of textual criticism is going to have good reason to reject most of the variants. And there will be a lot of commonality even between people who see textual criticism from a different standpoint. Now, the most common variable in the New Testament variant is the movable new. That's that if you have epsilon nu or epsilon or iota nu, there are certain circumstances under which certain words can either put an N or a nu or not put an N on the end of the word. That is by far and away the most common variant. And it would be like saying a history versus an history. Most people say an history. I'm convinced it should be a history. We won't go there. But it simply does not change the meaning whatsoever. Another common variant is illustrated by Dodeca versus Decadua, or Yodabeda. Dodeca is one word that means 12. The do comes from dua, which means two, and deca is the word for 10. Or Decadua, and that also means 12. Or it could be abbreviated. The letter Yoda in an abbreviation stands for 10, and Beta stands for 2. Well, if you see a manuscript that says Yoda Beta, you don't know whether the scribe, what he was copying from, said Duodeca, or you just don't know which word it is. It will be listed as a variant, but you cannot translate the difference. There was no such thing as standardized spelling before the printing press. It just didn't exist. Is David spelled with an upsilon or with a beta? There is major difference as far as how that's rendered. Does Nazareth end in a T or in a theta? I mean, just all sorts of variants like that. Only about 30,000 of the variants could change the translation of the text. So, I mean, you're down to about 10% out of that 300,000. And we drop down to about 10% of that, for only about 30,000 variants affect translation. Of the 30,000 that affect translation, only about 3,000 affect the meaning of the passage. In other words, we look at Matthew 24:36. If it doesn't say neither the Son, or if it does say it, what you would say that the passage says is going to be a little different. But when we look at Mark 13:32, we would have to say, well, even if Matthew doesn't say neither the Son, that Jesus, when he said only the Father knows, he even meant that not even the Son knows, even though the text doesn't say it, because Mark tells us what his meaning was. So it will affect translation, but does it affect my theology? No. Does it even affect how I will explain the passage? No. Because I wouldn't say in one passage, well, the Son knows here and the Son doesn't know on the other. So what happens is it keeps getting to be a smaller and smaller and smaller proportion of things. So, even though some will expect change the exposition of a passage, very few affect our ultimate theology. Let's talk about those that would affect our theology. And here, this is a question that you raised. People often wonder about heresy coming in through the acceptance of wrong textual variants. However, many letters dating from about AD 200 and following warn churches against uncritically accepting readings of itinerant preachers. They say, if he says something strange, check it against your better manuscripts. That would be in a nearby scriptorium, which is a place where they copied manuscripts. So, what I would have to say is that I am convinced that the majority text is the best Greek text. But if I suddenly became persuaded that the Alexandrian texts were superior, it would not suddenly transform my theology and my exposition. Because there is not a great deal that is hinging on textual variants where we'd say, you know, this is the only passage where we find this truth, and it depends on whether this word is here or it's not here as to whether that doctrine exists. That's just a very rare thing, because if you think about these scribes, or people keeping an eye out for intentional changes, there aren't going to be very many significant things that are going to have enough representation that anyone would take it seriously. In other words, Erasmus went out and bought a couple manuscripts. But when they're going to produce a translation of the Bible, it isn't someone goes out and buys a couple manuscripts. What they're doing is they're looking at texts that have been evaluated by people who might have very different textual theories, but there's a commonality as to what will be rejected by all current textual theories that are accepted. So in other words, one doesn't have to say, well, if I change text, it's going to transform me into an absolute heretic. That isn't going to happen. But the big question isn't, is the word chi the word and in this verse, or is it in that verse? Because that's by far and away the bigger sets of things, where you look at it and you say, okay, it'll change my translation. I put the word and in here, but if I didn't have it, I'd put a comma there. And, you know, most of the variants are really, really minor. But what's the big fuss about? Ultimately, it's, do we include whole passages like Mark 16, 9 to 20, John 7, 53 to 8, 11, and so on and so forth? And those passages which have caused people even some theological problems, shouldn't. I can recommend an article. I'll send out a link to an article on a different way of approaching the interpretation of Mark 16, 9 through 20, that it does not teach baptismal regeneration. It's a whole different line when one looks at how it fits into the argument of Mark. Okay, let's look at my other handout. A case for the majority text. Okay, the earliest manuscripts were papyrus codices, because that was the common writing material. They were codices. Now, when I talk about codex, or codices as plural, that's a book with a central binding. New Testament manuscripts from the very beginning are in codex form. I have a whole appendix devoted to a proof of that assertion, because for my dissertation argument, that was an important issue for me to wrestle with. Because with scrolls, transpositions are difficult. But the authors used scrolls. They did not write on codices. Codex is a terrible form for an author. It's a publishing tool. Because, let me just quickly illustrate. Scrolls were normally only written on one side. The Bible mentions on four or five occasions epistographs. But people wrote in their laps. They didn't have writing desks until about the 8th century. Now, can you imagine working in your lap with a scroll upside down and trying to write here in this? Well, the scroll simply did not lend itself to working in the lap that way. The codex would. They were using individual sheets, not it wasn't bound when they did their scribal work. But anyway, the early papyrus manuscripts are all designated with the fancy P in front of it, indicating that it's papyrus. There was a technological improvement developed in Pergamos, which is, of course, mentioned in Revelation, that city, where they developed parchment. Parchment is an altered pronunciation of Pergamos. That's where the word comes from. And it's because that's where it was invented. It's stretched leather into which powder was rubbed in order to keep it from shrinking back to its original state. It had three big advantages. It allowed larger page size, and that's why manuscripts starting in the 4th century could include whole Bibles, Whereas before that, the Codex, if you had Mark, Luke, and John, that was beyond technologically good limits, and the manuscripts start, the books would fall apart. I mean, it's just interesting how it was beyond the technology, not only because of the writing material, but because of the method of binding. A second issue, it was smooth. Now, I've got a piece of papyrus, but I didn't locate it to bring it here for show and tell. It's much easier to write on parchment than it is to write on papyrus, because it has little grooves in it. But there's another thing. It has greater water resistance. If a papyrus manuscript got wet one time in its history, it's paper mache. One time. So if you have a papyrus manuscript, it has had to last about 2,000 years without getting wet once. Egypt is the only place dry enough that papyrus had a reasonable chance of continuing. They've only found about 100 of them for the whole New Testament. Most of them got wet, because interestingly enough, like here, because of the rivers, Nile River flooded on a regular basis. People normally lived down by the river. During flood states, they moved up. And there were countless manuscripts in the low towns that got flooded. The only manuscripts that have ever been found in Egypt were the ones that were in the towns that the people only lived in flood stage. I mean, and so you go elsewhere, and it's only because of parchment that you could have manuscripts surviving in wetter climates. So there's a technological issue, the switch from papyrus to parchment, that allowed manuscripts to survive in wetter climates. But what kind of manuscripts would they prefer in Egypt? Well, I don't think they're going to say, let's go buy some things from Pergamos. They're going to use papyrus. That's their native product, and so on and so forth. And so there ends up being an interesting interchange on that issue. Then I mentioned that later manuscripts, most majority manuscripts are within the era where they were writing with minuscule type, that is, writing with a lowercase font to get a few more words onto a page. And so their nomenclature is a little different. Okay, overview of printed Greek editions. So we're moving away from manuscript. Manus means hand. So we were looking at handwritten, now we're looking at printed. After Gutenberg invented movable type, Erasmus produced a Greek text after he bought a couple of manuscripts and produced it out of it. Not a critical edition. Then some publisher wanted to make sure that people wouldn't say, oh, well, why should I buy a Greek text from this publisher? Maybe he has a weird text. So he put a little publisher's blurb on the title page saying, the text received by all. What did he mean? I'm using Erasmus's text, the one that everyone else uses. It's not some oddball text. Well, guess where the term Textus Receptus came from? That little publisher's blurb. So Erasmus wouldn't know what you were talking about if you said, well, what did you think about creating the Textus Receptus? He never heard of that. But Textus Receptus is a way of referring to his text. Okay, then in 1881, Westcott and Hort produced their text, and they had a companion volume in which they made three arguments saying that the majority text was inferior. People accepted those arguments, and it was a very convenient thing, because now all of a sudden they only had to look at 20% of the manuscripts. It was a real labor saver. They came up with what looked like three really good arguments saying that the Byzantine text type was inferior. They found 8 alleged examples of conflation in the whole New Testament. And they said, The whole text, whole majority text, has to be inferior because of those eight occasions.
Conflation. Go ahead.
Conflation. Well, look at Luke chapter 24, verse 53. In Luke 24:53, the so-called Western manuscripts read one way, the Alexandrian manuscripts read a different way, and the majority texts read a different way. Notice it says they were continually in the temple praising and blessing God. So one of the, I think the Alexandrian reads, they were continually praising God. The so-called Western text says they were continually blessing God, and the majority text says they were continually praising and blessing God. So basically what was alleged was, at a certain point in time, someone decided to create a majority text, and he said, got two readings. Which should I choose? Oh, I'll do both. And so that's conflation. But the interesting thing is, in another book I didn't bring by Pickering, he shows a large number of contra-conflations that would go against the Alexandrian text, and so forth. What has ended up happening is all three of their actually, I did bring Pickering. So he argues there, he has a number of examples, but probably one of the more devastating arguments is by this book that I brought up earlier. This was a published form of a dissertation by Harry Sturtz. And, oh, he loves the detail. These appendices are just fascinating, where he's listing all sorts of readings from the papyri. Those early, definitely favoring Alexandrian manuscripts. I have to remember, Westcott and Hort wrote in 1881, before there were very many papyri discovered. And people have always said the papyri prove that the Alexandrian is really, really, really old. And that, but the interesting thing is there is a subcurrent. There are a lot of readings that had always been dismissed as very, very, very late in their origin that can be documented as existing by the year 200. And imagine what a fact like that does to an argument that said, late, 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 and it's early, 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 early. Westcott and Hort has been turned upside down to such a degree that no knowledgeable critical text scholar will accept their arguments as correct, proving that the majority family is inferior. But they still hold on to the conclusions. This is a devastating argument, but it's confirmed and agreed to by a large number of critical text scholars, because you don't find people appealing to Westcott and Hort, knowledgeable ones, as having proved their point, because the new evidence, that subcurrent that has come out, has ended up overturning their arguments, although their conclusions are still accepted. Now, Nicodemus, we'll get to your question at this juncture. Is, at page 2 of that set of notes, is older guaranteed to be better? And I would say no. Now, I'm going to make an analogy. King is going to be the name of a champion dog. In my case, it would be a German Shepherd. You can have whatever breed of dog or cat you want. But this is a champion. I mean, AKC registered and top quality bloodlines, and you know, I mean, it won best of show at the Westminster Kennel Club. I mean, it's just top dog. I mean, just absolutely top dog. It has only two offspring. One is going to be named Atlas, and the other is going to be named AWOL. And guess what AWOL did? AWOL went AWOL. And as a result, AWOL is going to have offspring that don't look the least bit like King. Because, you know, there's going to be a mixing of breeds that's going to be happening. On the other hand, Atlas stays home, and his breeding is very carefully regulated. So he has Bucephalus. And Bucephalus, do you think Bucephalus looks quite a bit like King? I think so. But AWOL has an offspring named Bozo. I think Bozo probably even looks less like King than AWOL did. And Clown is going to look even less like, and so we're going A, B, C, Z, C, D, all, we could go to Z, and A, A, B, B, and so on and so forth. Now let me ask you, if you were looking at someone that looks like King, are you expecting Z down here to look very much at all like King? No. In fact, even by the time you get down to D, whatever D's name is, it's not going to look very much like him. Now you go down this stream, and you can go down a lot further, and it's still going to look very much like a German Shepherd. It's going to look very much like King. But guess what happens to the DNA level? King's DNA with his offspring becomes 50%. Next generation, 25, 12 and a half, 6 and a quarter, 3 and an eighth. So even though D doesn't look at all like King, D has more of King's DNA than as you get further down this line. By analogy, this is the issue that has to be wrestled with. If there's cross-contamination, you can see why I use this as an illustration. If there's cross-contamination of readings because the scribes are not as careful, or you don't have someone looking over their shoulder and checking, you can have manuscripts that start getting different from each other. And the problem is, the Alexandrian manuscripts, even though they have all the advantages, they're early. They're all produced in one city, not in Athos, Greece, and in this place in Syria, and in this place in Constantinople, or here or there. One place, and they're early. We'd expect for there to be a strong degree of unity. Are we really expecting for there to be unity between a majority family manuscript that can be demonstrated to be produced in Turkey in the 12th century with another majority family manuscript being produced in Syria in the 10th century? You know, there's not going to be any close connection between them. And yet their readings tend to be much more similar than the Alexandrian manuscripts. Take a look at this photocopy that I gave you. The fascinating thing that is in an interesting text, this is the second edition of the Robinson Pierpont Byzantine Majority Text. If you have Bible Works and certain other programs, this text will be in there. It has about 200 places that it differs with Hodges Farstad text, about 100 times in Revelation, and 100 times in the rest of the New Testament. And guess what? They have different manuscripts that they prefer. These people prefer one set of majority manuscripts, and these prefer a different set. And 200 differences in the whole New Testament? That is a strong argument for the similarity between majority family manuscripts. How do you know a good manuscript from a bad manuscript? A good manuscript is going to look like its predecessor. Copies are going to look like each other. Bozo isn't going to look very much like King. But Bucephalus will. The way that we find out if there's good copying is, can we find manuscripts that are similar to each other? The higher the degree of similarity, if the manuscripts are not father to son, and there are only a small number of father to son manuscripts, in the whole collection of New Testament manuscripts, there are only a couple dozen of those relationships where you say, this guy was copying from this manuscript. I mean, otherwise it's different locale, different century, and it was obviously at a different manuscript that was being copied from based on the errors that show up. If you're not looking at father-to-son relationships, but you're looking at that spread of manuscripts, how is it that there's a high, high degree of unity among families of manuscripts that are produced here, hundreds of miles away there, hundreds of miles away there, hundreds of miles away there, and they're all much later? How do we account for them? Well, we have to posit that if within the majority family we can go back to this date and know we don't have anything above it, and we look at the Alexandrian and we look and we say, ooh, the slope as far as the number of variants that are showing up is very close to horizontal. We say, well, if we went all the way back to the beginning, they'd still have that kind of slope. But if it's a much slower accretion of variants, that's pointing to a slower level here. Now notice, I've been generous. Here, my slopes, I didn't draw my slope like this versus like this. But the relative degree of how fast the spread is a big issue. So would I rather have a majority manuscript closer to the top? Absolutely. But when we say older is better, it's older within a family.
How do they determine the ages of the families? Which one's older?
It's the manuscripts. There are issues of page format. There are issues which not only includes the material it's written on, but also includes the page size once, because there were certain... as they produced codices, there were standardized sizes, just like you go to a bookstore and you can't just find any size of book. There tend to be some standardization. Also, the style of printing, how you wrote individual letters, changed over time. And certain abbreviations that were used to save space developed at certain points of time. So, in other words, there are lots of issues that can be determined. Plus, we have a reasonable number of manuscripts that the scribe wrote what the date was that he completed the manuscript. And so we have all sorts of evidence, or he might say that such and such was being sent to so and so 20 years after this happened and such and such. You know, there end up being these little notes that happen on the side. So there papyrologists and all sorts of people wrestle with issues in order to determine dates. And so, the manuscript, a lot of work has been devoted to that. There's a specialized body of really expensive literature on all of that. But essentially, the majority argument is one that focuses upon if there is careful transmission in the period of time that we are looking at, that's a really significant issue. This particular excerpt out of Robinson Pierpont's text, that's this text here, turn to the third page of the note. What he argues in the second paragraph of the third page and following, along with the footnotes, is that if you look at the manuscripts that Nestle-Aland, which is the main text that's being used, or UBS, same people, same text, just a different format for the listing of variants, you can find, if you go through a whole page of text, there are many occasions where you cannot find a single manuscript out of all of the manuscripts that they collated. And remember, collation is looking at what did all the manuscripts read, every word, where you can't find a single manuscript that supports what they say on that page of their text. And indeed, he lists a number of examples where you can't find a single manuscript of all of the ones that they collated that agrees all the way through one verse. Those would be verses that are problematic verses. But as I conclude here at the bottom of the page, I say, other set of notes on the practical resolution, that's bottom of overview of textual variation. I say that textual critics need to be consistent as to which manuscripts are their core. Here's what I mean by core. Do I say, oh, I love Vaticanus. That's the manuscript I love. But here, oh, no, I just can't go with Vaticanus' reading. I've got to go with this one. And then I go a little further and I have to switch to another. That's essentially what Alexandrian prioritists who follow the eclectic method. Reasoned eclecticism is by far and away the most common textual procedure that's used, which says we'll follow things unless we think we know better. And we'll have a different group of Alexandrian manuscripts we prefer. Well, what ends up happening if we say reading one, well, you know, I'm going with P75. I mean, you know, P75 is my hero. And we get a little further in the verse and we say, oh, forget what P75 says. I'm going with Vaticanus. Then we go a little further in the verse. No, P75 messed up and Vaticanus messed up. I am going with Sinaiticus. Who's the authority there? Is it really the manuscript? Or is it the text critic? And so there are portions within the majority family that we regard as we go where they go, even if it's not the text we like. Because what Hodges and Farstad did was in their collation work, they determined which subtypes of the majority family seem to evidence the greatest level of consistency, a resistance to cross-contamination. And those are the manuscripts, that subgrouping in each portion of the New Testament, there end up being three different subgroupings depending on if we're Revelation, or we're in the Pericope Adulteri, or the rest of the New Testament. They would consistently go with what the subclass that they had determined was the most consistent. So it's not a back and forth type of thing. This, I think, is a huge indictment of the reasoned eclectic view.
Yes. Discuss your bracket aspect.
Oh,
here.
Brackets. Yes.
But then that's not my real one.
Okay. There are hundreds of places in the Nestle-Aland text, the main text that most people use, that have brackets. If you look in the apparatus for the majority text. Every time that the critical text has a bracket, they always comment on it. Here's a brief. What they're saying when they put a bracket around a word is, if we go with internal evidence, we would favor this reading. If we go with external evidence, we would favor that reading. And they're saying, tell you what, definite maybe. Because they're saying, it all depends on whether you, as a reasoned eclectic, are going to value the best manuscripts, or whether you're going to follow the best argument for what it looks like the scribe did. They have that hundreds of times. What they're telling you is, our text theory is leading us in two different directions. Anytime you see a bracket in a text, in a Greek text, it's an admission that they have run into a roadblock on their method and they don't know what to do. Every single one of them should be regarded as a failure. And so there are articles that are being written by Alexandrian prioritists, people who favor the critical text, that are saying such things as the interlude in New Testament textual criticism and the continuing interlude. They're saying, please, won't someone come up with a theory to replace Westcott Hort? We don't know what to do because we know that Westcott and Hort's arguments are not sound. We like their conclusions, but we'd like to have some guidance as to which manuscripts to prefer. There is a fascinating, and this would be an interesting thing to do a thesis on. It's no longer in the 28th edition, but the 27th edition has what they call editionem differentiae. Differences between editions. All of these texts here are predecessor texts to this, and also Tischendorf's 8th, and then I won't put all four volumes about von Soden, but what they're saying is, wow, all these texts that all prefer the Alexandrian, all prefer those early Egyptian manuscripts. And they've got almost 8,000 places where they are disagreeing with each other as to which Alexandrian reading they want. In other words, if someone says, I like the Alexandrian manuscripts, what do they end up choosing? Westcott and Hort made a statement that most people regard as a positive statement. If Sinaiticus, that manuscript, and Vaticanus agree, the text is certain. Well, Sinaiticus and Vaticanus in the New Testament disagree 3,000 times. So that if is a big if. I mean, here we are looking at essentially people have a population of about 8,000 variants, maybe 10,000, that they're actively wrestling with. And out of those two manuscripts have 3,000 places they differ with one another. And those are the core manuscripts. It's like the amount of room for play is huge. So I think we probably have hit our time and that, but...
Well, we're going to keep you as long as we can.
Okay, very good.
The big question in my mind, and maybe this has done a disservice, is, and I have the debate of the King James only, let me phrase this in a neutral way.
Sure.
What do you think is the overriding motivation of how they picked the text? Was it theological, or is it dogma of the methodology?
It kind of is some of each.
Okay, because what has hurt probably the aspect of majority or Textus Receptus being valid is the arguments are, the whole thing has been a and maybe it's true, I'm just asking, a great conspiracy. And all scholarship was debunked and became subservient to theological liberalism. But if that's true, that's fine. But or to what degree do you see that or not see it?
I see individual passages where theology becomes a tipping point. I'll give an illustration. I've written a major paper on Revelation 5, verses 9 and 10. And it's an interesting passage because I think that the critical text gets it, critical text-based translations get it right in 5:10, but they get it wrong in 5:9.
Now this is what, Revelation?
Revelation 5, verses 9 and 10. This passage, by the way, changed my view of when the Bema happens. Because until I wrestled with this passage, I always took a standard view that the Bema seat occurred during the tribulation. And with this passage, it forced me to change that it happens in the interval between the rapture and the start of the tribulation. This passage forces that. But let me show you how this passage runs, because I'm going to point out one variant in verse 9 that the King James and New King James get right because the TR had it right. And verse 10, there are two errors by the TR, so they get it wrong. In verse 9... Let me give a circumstance. There's a scene up in heaven in which a search is undertaken to find someone who is worthy to open this epistograph. An epistograph is a scroll written on both sides. You remember how I said that's really rare. And so what was happening there is John started crying because in the vision nobody was found initially who was worthy to open up the scroll. And the way that I would understand where it has seven seals is that the scroll is rolled partway, a wax seal is put, rolled a little further, another wax seal is rolled a little further, another wax seal, and so he's going to break seals one at a time on this scroll. And so there's going to be an angelic choir that's going to sing, but it also necessarily includes humans. This passage, if we take the text properly, identifies the 24 elders as human beings. We have a mixed choir that is singing, because it includes four living creatures and the 24 elders. And what is it that they're saying in this new song? Worthy is he to open the book, the scroll, and to open its seals. Who is slain, who has redeemed us. Now, some of your translations don't have us in there. Who redeemed us by his blood out of every tribe and tongue and people and nation. That is a standard phrase that is used to refer to Gentiles. Every tribe, tongue, people, and nation. But if he has redeemed us, it's not angels singing about human beings, it's human beings singing about human beings. And this is an antiphonal arrangement for the song. An antiphonal arrangement would be like in Messiah, Handel's Messiah, sometimes you have one group that's singing and another group, they're there, but they're not singing. And you have another group that's singing. Well, people, all of them could say in unison, we just perform the Messiah. We just sang it. But that didn't mean every person sang every word of Handel's Messiah. When it says that the 24 elders and the four living creatures sang, it doesn't mean that every one of them said every word. A new song can have antiphonal parts. We have antiphonal songs in the Psalter where that occurs, where this line is sung by one group and then his mercies endure forever. And the group sings again, and this group answers, his mercies endure forever. This group sings the next line, his mercies endure forever. And so it's going a back and forth type of thing. And the reason I say it goes back and forth is because this group grows. First it becomes every angel, then it becomes these multitudes and multitudes of angels, and then finally every creature in heaven and under the earth and on the earth and so on and so forth. And then it shrinks back down and it gets to be a small group and a small group all over. So different groups are singing different amounts of the material. But if the us is there, it identifies these as humans. Guess what? Guess how many manuscripts leave out the word us? One. But guess what? It is the favorite manuscript of critical text people. It's Alexandritus. But I have to tell you something about how it shows up. I've got a Bible here that has columns. When you look at the manuscript, at the bottom of the page, it looks like his ink is not quite as dark. Then you get up to the top of the next column and it looks darker. And the scribe of Alexandrinus, as he moved from one column to the top of the next and dipped his pen in ink, left out hamas. He left out the word us. This is a place where it's easy to understand him having a scribal lapse of concentration. Here he is, bottom of column, top of next column. And so the way that it's rendered in ESV would be along the line is that he redeemed people out of every tribe, tongue, people, and nation. As you read it from that standpoint, it can be angels singing about humans. Every non-pre-trib person, every author who holds a non-pre-trib view will argue that the 24 elders are angels and that they are singing about human beings, and they all reject the word us. Now, in verse 10, one time says us and one time says we. But that should be they and them. Getting back to the passage, and so there it reads, and you have made them, and the them is the proper reading. So King James and New King James are wrong because it acts as though it's still the 24 elders singing. You have made them kings and priests to our God. And they will reign upon the earth. It doesn't say they're reigning now, but they will. But what happens in chapter 6, verse 1? 6:1, we have the opening of the first seal. That's the start of the tribulation. I think the rapture is alluded to in chapter 4, verse 1, but if these people have been pronounced that they are, right now, kings and priests, who will reign, how could that be conferred upon them without the Bema Seat having happened? So this passage caused me to move from seeing the Bema Seat as during the tribulation to during the interval between the rapture and the tribulation. All non-pre-trib people reject the us, because they do not want for there to have been the Bema Seat before the start of the tribulation. That's a very interesting issue. And the fact that none of the Greek texts, other than Hodges Farstad and Robinson Pierpont, were written by pre-trib people, you have to wonder, why is it that they would go with one manuscript? That is called going with a solecism. And you should see how fiercely Hollande argues that text critics should never go with a reading that only has one manuscript supporting it. Because that's a solecism, and the chance that it's an error is so high. And especially when it's between columns. I've looked at facsimiles of the manuscript. I've seen it with my own eyes. And I look at it, and it says to me, that scribe had a momentary lapse, and there should be other manuscripts supporting that reading before people would say dogmatically, this is the text. And guess what? In those variants between, within the Alexandrian family, represented by the over 7,000 differences between these texts, Nestle and Hollande are on. They're kind of struggling because a lot of these texts ended up saying, we think it went the other way.
Well, the big one out there, though, is that Nestle and Hollande, Westcott and Hort had a campaign to eliminate the deity of Christ in all the that was the main aspect of all the. Do you see that?
I don't know whether that was the case. I know it's often addressed. It's often raised. I'm not sure that how to answer that as to whether that was a conspiracy on their part. Westcott and Hort were both trained classicists. And they wrote before very many of the papyri had been discovered. And it was before the era of the papyri, people really struggled to classify New Testament Greek because there wasn't much Greek that looked like it. It was unique enough that people had coined a term where they called it Holy Spirit Greek. What they were saying is, all these guys that wrote these different books of the New Testament all kind of fit into an oddball Greek. It must have been that they were all kind of together and just kind of developed their own dialect. And maybe they were in churches together or something, but somehow they really developed this weird thing. Westcott and Hort would have struggled with that. And the atticistic issue, atticism is, it's an adjective that comes from the word Athens. And so there were, there's been a lot of debate as to whether atticisms, that is, Greek that looks like the way that people spoke Greek in Athens, would be likely to be original. And so critical text people are always struggling over that issue because some of the primary Alexandrian manuscripts have a lot of Athens-type Greek, have a lot of the Atticisms. And Westcott and Hort were very much attracted to Atticisms because they were classically trained at a time that New Testament Greek looked peculiar. So my suspicion is that their classical training may have led them to say, these have got to be the better Greek these have to be the better manuscripts because they're the better Greek. We just can't imagine that people would write with this oddball style that nobody's ever heard of. And so as I see features like that, I'm not ready to say that I just haven't seen evidence that says that how to answer your question, whereas I have seen evidence there that points to, you know, they just really thought some of this Greek was really weird. And they were attracted to Greek that looked more like what they had studied.
What do you think the safety as far as Christian accuracy of Hartmann, Gingrich, and Bauer as far as a lexicon?
There have been places that I've gone through and translated from the German what they have done, because the English editors have done a fair amount of changing, especially in the second edition. Second edition is a lot different than fifth edition German. And I found some places where it was very significant, the nature of the changes that they made. They do have theological axes to grind. Replacement theology is alive and well within their work, and so for example, their treatment of the term eudaios, that can be translated Jew or Judean, is very heavily tainted by replacement theology. But replacement theology has been alive in Germany for centuries and centuries and centuries. And it's kind of odd what the new edition of Bauer, Art, and Gingrich has done. They said, well, it means Jews, but we really ought to translate it Judeans, because Jew has a pejorative meaning. as like, wait a moment. You're going to be politically correct, and you're going to do something other than what it means because you think that the term will be... it's like, what? I mean, that is not good lexicography. I mean, I run into statements that appear in these things, and it's just astounding. I supervised a thesis on the meaning of eudaios in the Gospel of John. I mentioned in the morning session that I see it as meaning Judean in John's Gospel. It's a term like Yankee. If someone in Mississippi says Yankee, go home, they mean one thing. But if someone in Iran says Yankee, go home, they don't care if you're from north or south of the Mason-Dixon line. And when you have passages that are referring to the eudaioi versus the Gentiles, well, it's true. But if it's the eudaioi versus the Galileans, then it's Judean. And John's Gospel gives evidence that throughout he means Judean. And the concept of Jew as the translation plays right into replacement theology, because it is taken as a code word for unbeliever. Let me explain what led to people saying that Jew is a code word in John for unbeliever. I said, Jesus spoke John chapter 8 in the treasury. John 8:20 says that. The treasury is either the western portion of the court of the women, or it is another designation for the whole court of the women. Either one of those possibilities. So, Court of the Women has a restriction. No Gentile can enter it. And one of the stone placards that was outside of the vestibule leading up into the Court of the Women told Gentiles, if you pass this point, They may kill you. So everyone in John 8 is shush, right? They're in the court of the women. So why is it that John's gospel says, Jesus said to the Jews said to Jesus, Jesus said to the Jews said to Jesus? How many times in this lecture have I mentioned the word Americans? I don't say, you know what Americans think? I can tell you what Americans think. I've run into some. I mean, if I said, I told the Americans things about textual criticism, and the Americans said this in response, and then I told the Americans. That would be very stilted language. The way that John uses the term eudaios says that he is not one of them. And so people have said, because of a couple passages that I think they misunderstand, well, the term means Jew. But John was born a Jew. If John was born a Jew, and John doesn't regard himself a Jew, then he must mean, well, now I'm a Christian. I used to be a Jew before I was a believer. So they say Jew in John's gospel means unbeliever. So now we have John chapter 8, verse 31, where Jesus addressed the eudaioi who believed in him. And you run into people writing things like this. Well, since eudaioi, Jew, is a code word for unbeliever, John is telling us that these people didn't really believe, even though he said that they believed. I did a major paper on that. I presented it at GES this past year, and a student of mine that Brad knows well wrote a really nice thesis arguing that all 70 uses of the term eudaios mean Judean in John's gospel. Other contexts, like the word Yankee, it flexes. But when you're designating people within a book, it needs to have consistent meaning. But furthermore, in John's gospel, it has a positive meaning. Jesus told the Samaritan woman, salvation is of the eudaioi. And she told him, how is it that you, being a eudaios, that's singular form, how is it that you, being a Jew, no, how is it that you, being a Judean, ask a drink from me, a Samaritan woman? And Jesus accepted her calling him a eudaios. He didn't say, oh no, I'm not one of them. But furthermore, salvation is of the eudaioi. Let me explain the significance of that. She said that she knew that Messiah was coming, and when Messiah came, he would tell them all things. But the Samaritan Messiah was regarded as a Zadokite. Tahabe was regarded as a descendant of Zadok, of the tribe of Levi. Why is it important? Levi can be in any geographic locale. They were spread throughout the country because, you know, how they had the Levitical cities and so on and so forth. And the Samaritans were strongly opposed to the idea that the Messiah, that Tahabe, would be from Judah. And Jesus is saying deliverance is of the Judeans, specifically of the Davidites, because he is a descendant of David. And what happened? The people there recognized that Jesus is right, where they say, he indeed is the Messiah, the deliverer of the world. They're saying, here we have a Judean, and he is the Messiah. They are rejecting their theology that they have been taught year after year after year. It's a really significant thing. John's gospel does not use the term eudaios as a bad term. But most of the opposition to Jesus was centered in Jerusalem, which was the capital of Judea. Look at John 7:1. And John 7:1 goes a long way to defining terms for us. So, yes, I do think there are theological axes to grind. 7:1, after these things, Jesus walked in Galilee, for he did not want to walk in Judea, because the Judaoi sought to kill him. Hmm. Well, there are Jews up in Galilee. there even were some Judeans, but the opposition was centered among the Judean religious leadership. And so for 1 year he boycotted Jerusalem. And that can be demonstrated. He did not go to Jerusalem between the Feast of Booths in John 5 and his return to Jerusalem for the Feast of Booths a year later in John chapter 7. A demonstration of that is Matthew 17 has the temple tax passage, and it's within that same chronology. Have you ever seen a tax collector who didn't have authority to force you to pay a tax? Yeah. Here you've got someone asking people, do you want to volunteer to pay a tax? Well, Warren Buffett would volunteer. but that's not normally the case. Temple tax. The passage was up in Galilee. He had no authority up in Galilee to force anyone to pay the tax. But who is it that they collected the temple tax from? People who hadn't paid it at the last Passover. That's a statement that Jesus hadn't been to Passover. And so John 7 says he didn't want to walk in Judea. Well, he hadn't walked there for a year. He stayed out of there. John's Gospel is a fun book, but yeah, there are theological axes to grind, absolutely.
Right, I took too much. This is your class, so you can go ahead. Now that I run it as much as I want to.
You're welcome to ask questions.
But I would just like still say, it's such a big thing out there in our circles,
sure,
that everything was all, and I think it's running counter interference to the scholarship of,
sure,
the majority text, that almost an embarrassment for you is for.
Sure. What happened after Hodges and Farstad published, they came under bitter attack from the King James only people and the Textus Receptus only people. Those are two different groups. Because I have to tell you, one of the interesting things with the King James translators is whenever they got lost, they abandoned the Greek and they went to the Latin. And so there are interesting places where that's evident. And so people who say King James only, if they really mean King James only, they'll follow it even when it follows the Latin against the Greek. And if you're talking to someone who truly is a Textus Receptus only, they're saying that Greek text is the proper text. I think it's a very provincial view. It's extremely provincial because how is it that a translation that happens years later attests what God was doing in the first century? Manuscripts are where the evidence should be, but Hodges and Farstad came under pretty vehement attacks at that point. Subsequent to their publication, also, there has been quite a bit of discussion within the majority family group of scholars as to how to approach minority readings. Let me explain. I was saying that there is a smaller stream, that is, that majority text manuscripts go more like this rather than more like this. But the fact of the matter is, there are places where there are differences, and where there are bad splits within the majority family of manuscripts. That does happen. So now the question becomes, how do you approach those? Do you say, well, we'll go with the biggest subgroup of the majority family? Well, if we don't have a majority, let's go with plurality. Or do you go about scientifically trying to determine what manuscripts are the most consistent? What subgroup are the most consistent? And Hodges and Farstad came under quite a bit of fire from some majority text advocates when they published, because they call this a majority text and they have some minority readings. I mean, in other words, Hodges and Farstad's preferred subgroups were not always the biggest subgroups within the majority family. And so they were looking, where was their consistency, and let's go with that. Let me clarify something, because at some point, as you might do more work in textual criticism, and you just start looking at the apparatus of Hodges and Farstad, you may notice that sometimes they have a Gothic M for saying what the majority reading is. Sometimes they have an English M, and then sometimes they have MPT. Anytime it says MPT, M partem, that means there's a split within the majority family. M means the majority, including the so-called Jerusalem text. Okay, other people call it the Western text. The reason that they refer to it as the Jerusalem text is because that was the preferred term by von Soden, and von Soden is a major part of their organization of the material. That belongs up here. Whereas this is without the Jerusalem text. So, in other words, the core majority manuscripts are here. When they go with a reading down here, they're saying the more reliable subportion, if there's a split. And so, it's a matter, being a serious text critic is expensive. I mean, you just buy books. To be serious in this, you just spend money. And then you go to the libraries for the things you can't afford. And I mean, I have used books that are $300 a volume, and that's like, oh, it'd be nice to own that, but I'm not.
Well, you are still married.
Yep.
Ready now.